there. Good evening. Welcome to the Jim Bohannon Show from Westwood One Radio. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Online, you'll find us at jimbotalk.net, and you can follow me on Twitter at jimbotalks. Oops, he's got a gun. Must be a danger. Must be a threat. Well, that would depend on the circumstances, and it is certainly not an automatic. Got a gun, he's a danger. Nonetheless, that is an equation that we're hearing more and more about these days, and so we thought we would invite in one of the world-recognized experts on guns and crime, the president of Crime Prevention Research Center, the author of Dumbing Down the Courts, How Politics Keeps the Smartest Judges Off the Bench. John Lott joins us tonight. Good evening, John.
Great to talk to you again, Jim.
Absolutely. So let's start. I believe it was the New York Times, the latest to enter this particular territory. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, the New York Times, I guess, has tried to enter into it a couple times over the last week. But last week they had a long editorial claiming that over the last 8 years, concealed carry permit holders had killed 722 people. Kind of a startling claim that was there. And they were claiming that, if anything, no one could dispute those numbers and that the full death total was probably much higher. But you know, I guess they should have checked their numbers a little bit. It's amazing the errors that were in it. About 38% of these 722 deaths were supposedly from one state, Michigan. And almost all those were suicides. The problem is they didn't actually check the numbers very carefully because there were permit holders that committed suicide, but we don't even know whether those individuals committed suicide with a gun or whether they committed it in their home. And so the whole point of having a concealed handgun permit would have been kind of irrelevant.
And, well, you're not concealing it from yourself.
Yeah, correct. And also, the permit just allows you to have the gun outside the home. So somebody could have had a gun in the home without a permit and commit suicide. But probably the most damning thing is that permit holders in Michigan actually have a suicide rate about one-third the suicide rate of other adults in Michigan. So somehow this notion that allowing people to own a permanent concealed handgun was causing them to go and commit suicide seems a bit of a bridge too far.
It really does. I must say, very frankly, if I was involved in a massive effort to do everything in my power, the facts be damned, everything in my power to discredit gun ownership and the carrying of firearms, I think I could have put together a better propaganda piece than that. I mean, that's almost embarrassing at just the level of competence. It wasn't a very good hit job.
No, I mean, it's amazing. And then when you even take the murders, it gets even more bizarre, because the state of Michigan police put out a report every year where they have pending cases. So let's say you get arrested. You may have used a gun legitimately in self-defense. Well, an arrest counts as a pending case. So for that year, it's going to be listed as pending. And then a few of those actually do end up getting convicted. But let's say you have a case where it could have been pending over 2 or 3 years. Often murder cases take a while to go to court, even if they decide to take it to court. The way they have it counted is each year a case would be pending, they count that as a separate murder. So let's say, and they also have newspaper articles. So it gets covered in the newspaper when the person gets first arrested, and then if it gets pending for 2 years, that counts as two more times. So you have three cases, three counts of murder there where it may turn out that the person is found to have acted in legitimate self-defense, and yet they would count that as three separate murders.
That's really bizarre. As I said earlier, and I don't think that this would be an unfair charge, it sounds like the anti-gun crowd is getting so desperate that they're just willing to come up with virtually anything. I mean, I'm really amazed that in a way, I suppose I'm actually heartened. If they have to dig this deep to find BS that thick, frankly, that may indicate that even they are beginning to realize how bankrupt are some of their ideas.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I view it the same way. And you would think at some point, even if the New York Times publishes this stuff, other reporters, when they would hear about the mistakes, would be reticent to go and repeat them. I mean, the thing with the New York Times is that these errors in this data that they're using has been pointed out previously. I mean, they could have done a Bing or a Google search on this and found these types of errors. I don't know whether they just didn't double-check the stuff before they used it or whether they double-checked it and decided to go ahead anyway with it. But, I mean, I posted I had a piece at Fox News earlier this week on Monday that goes through it, and you can go and read. I have links to the Michigan State Police reports and other things, and you can go and see the errors that I just went through.
And that's one thing, by the way, if you ever have dealt with John Lott, he is meticulous about researching, about attribution, footnotes and the like. If you're going to get into a contest with John, you better not be slinging too much bull, because he will expose that fact in short order. 1-866-50-JIMBO is our number. 1-866-505-4626. As we can, for the moment, I think, relax a bit about the notion they've got a gun, they're dangerous. I've got several. I must be really dangerous. We'll be back with more on the Bohannon Show in just a moment. Welcome back. This is the Jim Bohannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. We're talking with John Lott. He has been employed at a variety of academic institutions, the University of Chicago, Yale, Wharton School, the University of Pennsylvania, at the University of Maryland College Park, and at the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank. He holds a doctorate in economics from UCLA, and he knows his stuff about guns and gun crime. Looking at the New York Times article, were there other aspects of it that that struck you as being particularly egregiously wrong?
Well, I mean, the point of the article is essentially to say that we can't trust concealed carry permit holders and that we need to reconsider these laws. I guess the point I would make is that, you know, if you consider the fact, one thing they didn't mention was that there are over 12 million concealed carry permit holders right now in the United States. I'm not going to go and argue that there's never been a problem with any permit holders, but what I would say is that you have to look at it as the rate of problems that occur, and permit holders are extremely law-abiding. I mean, if you look at any type of firearms-related violation that permit holders get convicted of, they actually get convicted at a lower rate, much lower rate than police officers do. I mean, police officers are pretty law-abiding individuals. They rarely get convicted of crimes involving firearms. And yet what you find is that concealed carry permit holders are convicted at a rate of less than one-tenth the rate that police officers are convicted.
So, really?
Yeah.
Well, that's a sterling record any way you slice it.
Yeah, no, it's pretty amazing. It's hard to think of any other segment of the population that's anywhere near as law-abiding. If they had some intent on going out and committing a crime, they're not going to bother to go through the process of going and getting a concealed handgun permit.
No kidding. I mean, people might want to stop and think about what John Lott just said. I have a tendency to commit a crime, or I'm even contemplating committing a crime. So I am going to subject myself to that entanglement of paperwork? I don't think so.
Right.
I mean, there may be some who would do that, but we're talking about pretty semi-literate dodos here. I mean, my goodness, you know, any crook with two digits at least to his IQ is going to figure this out. Or even if, you know, I don't want to leave out the option, I might just hit that 7-Eleven on the corner there.
Right.
You are not going to go through the process.
Right. I mean, the type of person who gets a concealed handgun permit, they're extremely law-abiding. They have a lot to lose. Law-abiding citizens, you know, you do something wrong, you get a felony, your life is going to be unalterably changed. I mean, you're going to lose your business license, your professional license. you know, beyond the other types of criminal penalties that you're going to face. And what you find is that since law-abiding citizens have so much to lose, these people are extremely careful. They don't use, you know, they reuse their guns only as a last resort. And, you know, one could almost argue sometimes they're almost too reticent to use them, but they are, they're not the type of people that, you know, kind of the mythology points to as somehow being gun-happy individuals there that, you know, they use it because they're concerned about their safety. Mm-hmm. And they're very careful.
It is odd, again, that this would be the target group of all the people out there. I mean, certainly there are people in this society who abuse guns. They are, don't tend to be people who acquire them legally, and certainly not those who use them legally. But of all the people, these carry permit holders, for Pete's sake, I mean, they undergo the most scrutiny. I don't know what the washout rate is for that, but I mean, they would, statistically, you would think that the results would be just as you described, that having gone through that scrutiny, that they would be the least likely to commit such a crime.
Right. I mean, one of the things with the gun control debate over time is that every time a state passes a concealed carry law, the predictions have pretty much been the same. You're going to have blood in the street, you're going to have irresponsible behavior by permit holders. You know, after a year, you look at the states and you'll see newspaper headlines that say the same thing time after time. The predictions didn't come true. And you would think gun control advocates would realize that they lose credibility when they go and make those types of claims and they continually turn out not to be true. But you see this debate over and over again as we slowly get rid of some gun-free zones that we've had, you know, areas where permit holders aren't allowed to carry guns. You see the same type of debate occurring. You know, what's going to happen if you allow people to carry permit concealed handguns in malls or other types of areas? And you know, they're going to behave the same as they did outside of that. And yet the same predictions are made and the same predictions are shown to be false time and time again.
Which raises an interesting question, too, and that is, you say that after states have adopted concealed carry and after a year you see the headlines indicating that the fear stories were not true, where do you see those headlines? Do you have to read John Lott's blog to see them, or are, in fact, reporters actually reporting all of that?
Well, for those types of stories, you do, because it was usually such a big issue with the law being adopted to begin with, you do see headlines in the major state newspapers looking at it. You know, the reporters do go in and look at those things. Now, maybe lots of other things they don't cover, but that's one thing that they do cover. And another just point, just to show the lack of problems with this, there's no state that's repealed its concealed carry law. Indeed, there's no state that's even had legislative hearings on repealing the concealed carry laws after they've been adopted. You would think at least a couple times you would have had legislative hearings just out of, you know, randomness occurring there, but yet you don't see them. It just shows you it becomes a non-issue when people realize that the predictions that were being made just never occur.
Has there ever been an instance that went the other way, even an exception to the rule, that in most states you pass concealed carry and the crime rate does not go through the roof? In fact, it often goes down. Has there ever been an exception, one that you could point to as an exception to the rule, but nonetheless, do they have any ammo on their side?
Well, I mean, I think if they had ammo in those states, they would have at least tried to go and bring up, you know, hearings or something to talk about repealing it. You know, right now, every state in the country, and now even the District of Columbia, now issues concealed handgun permits. Obviously, in the District of Columbia, it's like six people that they've granted permits to.
Seriously? Six out of 600,000 residents?
Right. It's not exactly what something you'd write about a lot, you know, to brag about, but hopefully they'll begin to change a little bit. I mean, it's the question the courts, the people who brought the suit to begin with that forced the District of Columbia to grant those six permits are saying, look, they're not really fulfilling the court decision that mandated that they open up the process. They're just trying to say, do it for somebody, and then not feel that they have to do it for anybody else. But my guess is there'll be additional court decisions that will force them to have to open it up even further. And there's a case out in California that I think has a reasonable chance of eventually making it to the Supreme Court, because right now you have two different types of states. You have 42 states that have what we call right to carry laws, which once somebody meets a certain age, pass criminal background check, pay their fee, do the training that's required, once they meet those criteria, then they get the permit. Then you have eight other states that may have those rules, but then in addition, you have to demonstrate some type of need and prove that you deserve to be able to go and get that permit. And D.C. is now one of those places. And so, you know, the question is, how arbitrary are those rules? And what you find is that in places like Los Angeles County in California, there's only 240 people that have permits. But the type of person who gets permits are very well-connected, big political donors. They're not the types of people who actually benefit the most from owning guns. I mean, if my research convinced me of anything, it's the people who are most likely to be victims of violent crime who benefit the most from having the option to protect themselves. And that overwhelmingly tends to be poor blacks who live in high-crime urban areas. So Illinois is the last state to adopt concealed carry. They were forced to do so by the courts. And right now it costs over $600 to go and get a concealed carry permit. So they said, look, we're forced to do this. The courts are making it, so we're going to make it as costly as we can. There are about 100,000 people that have gotten concealed carry permits in Illinois over the last year. But the problem is that how many poor individuals who live in high-crime areas in Chicago have been able to go and apply for a permit successfully? It's not only do they have the $600 fee, but there are no training facilities in Chicago, and part of the law bans you being able to carry a permanent concealed handgun on public transportation. So if you're a poor person, and also it's 16 hours of training, so twice for two full days you're going to have to find some transportation out well into the suburbs to be able to go and get to a firing range to get your permit. And, you know, that and bear that $600 cost. There are not too many people who live in those high crime areas who are going to be able to afford the option to protect themselves.
How arbitrary are these rules? You have to demonstrate a need. What does that mean? You've been mugged. You regularly go to the bank carrying large amounts of cash. How arbitrary are those rules?
Well, it's very arbitrary. John Stossel at Fox, my son is a producer for his show, tried to go and get a concealed carry permit in New York City. He went to the police there, showed them that he had literally gotten dozens of death threats from people for his show. And, you know, I'm sure that's not too surprising for on-air personalities who take a stand on things. You know, I'm sure you probably have gotten a couple people ruffled over the years. And but the police in New York City said that that wasn't enough evidence to justify him getting a concealed carry permit.
Wow. We will pause on that note and continue our discussion. John Lott is our guest. He is a gun and crime violence expert and a man who has serious problems with the latest attack on concealed carry. 1-866-50-JIMBO. Back in a moment. Thank you for being with us on the Jimbo Hanna Show. Our guest is John Lott, the gun expert, a man who is, frankly, someone who has devoted, I guess you could say, his life to the subject of telling the truth about guns and crime. And he has done this in a variety of venues, including the American Enterprise Institute. And he is president of the Crime Prevention Research Center. His website is crimeresearch.org, crimeresearch.org. These battles are usually fought out at two levels, legislative and judicial. Let's start with the judicial. You made reference to a court case a moment ago. In the courts right now, or likely to be in the courts, what's happening that could affect the whole gun control debate one way or the other?
Well, there are a lot of different issues going on right now. One big topic in California, for example, is they have what they call micro-stamping, which is on the firing pin, you have a laser that etches in a little code number at the end of the firing pin, and then when it hits the bullet, it leaves a stamp there that could, in theory, allow somebody, if the bullet casing was left at the crime scene, then it could be traced back to the gun. Problem is when they passed the law, nobody had actually figured out how to actually use a laser to put an imprint on a firing pin that could actually be left on the bullet casing there. It, you know, it's just this theory, and they just assumed if they passed this law, it would work. There are multiple problems with it. One is just the gun makers are just not making guns that can be sold there in the state. So pretty soon, in a couple of years, you're very likely not to have any handguns that can legally be sold in the state of California, because none of them will meet this new rule. And so this essential ban on the sale of handguns is before the courts. Now, as a practical matter, even if they could figure out how to etch a small little code on the end of these small little firing pins such that it would actually be imprinted on the casing of a bullet, it's so easily defeated. I mean, somebody just has to replace the firing pin on a gun. I mean, you're talking about a trivially inexpensive item there that's very easy to replace on a gun. And so, you know, somehow you'd have to be assuming that criminals would know that their guns could be traced, but they're just not going to do anything like file the end of the firing pin or replace it with something else. And, if they picked up the casings that were after they fired them, even if they weren't smart enough to just replace the firing pin, it would defeat the whole purpose there. So I don't, if something that's expensive, with a lot of these rules, I think it's just another way of making it, just like with these fees that we were talking about before, just another way of making it costly for people to get guns. And I've unfortunately come to believe that that's really the motivation for a lot of these laws. So that's one major case. And as we were talking about before, the others, the Heller case, which struck down D.C.'s handgun ban, and the McDonald case that went to the Supreme Court that struck down the similar ban for Chicago, dealt with the ability for people to own guns in the home. Well, the Constitution, the Second Amendment says to keep and bear arms, and what the courts say is that to bear means to carry, and that has to do with having a gun outside the home. And so you have a range of cases now that are gradually working their way up to the Supreme Court about people being able to go and carry guns outside the home, concealed carry, and what types of regulations. So the things that we were talking about before, when you say go and demonstrate need, could you imagine with the First Amendment to go and demonstrate need to some government official to be able to go and print a newspaper? I mean, what would the courts do on something like that? It seems, I mean, your reaction, your laughter there is pretty typical what the courts would do if somebody were to have a rule like that.
So yeah.
Whether they, you know, what's going to happen with that's largely going to depend upon who's on the court at that time, because the two previous decisions were 5-4 decisions, and two of the five judges or justices who voted to strike down the Chicago and D.C. rules are going to be in their 80s by the end of the Obama administration. So if one of them were to die or retire within the next 2 years, you could see a very different court.
And in terms of that law, I must say that's unusual just for one reason alone, and that is usually laws and regulations trail far behind the technology. You're talking here about a case of a law that actually preceded the technology. That's pretty remarkable. Now, at the legislative level, what's being done to either pursue or to halt the progress of gun ownership?
Well, you have two distinct groups of states. You have a few states, I'd say maybe six or seven states, that regularly try to impose more gun control laws almost every time they get a legislative session. And then you have the rest of the country, which is pretty clearly moving to make it easier for people to be able to go and have guns for protection. So in the states that are moving towards more restrictive rules, the one common feature has frequently been just to make it more costly for people to obtain guns. So in 2013, Maryland introduced licensing and registration for handguns. It costs about $300 or so to go through the process to register a license and get the training to get a handgun in Maryland. In New York, and that same year, they passed a law that required that you had to go get a background check every time you were going to go and purchase ammunition, for example, and that would
every time you purchased ammunition.
Right. So, and the cost of doing that through a federally licensed dealer is about $80 in New York. So that would mean essentially an $80 fee over and above the cost of buying ammunition each time you bought it. And that's generally what you find with these rules, is that there's some dollar cost that's being imposed on people who are buying guns or ammunition in these different states. And I think it's part of this general pattern where they realize that the courts won't let them go and ban things. And so, just like in Illinois, making $600 to go and get a concealed handgun permit, they think that they figured out that the next best thing to do is just to impose taxes and fees on people being able to go and get guns.
More to come. Stay with us. 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. How do you feel about what we've been talking about? Back in a moment. Welcome back to the Jimbo Haddon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO. We talk with gun expert John Lott. He is the president of the Crime Prevention Research Center. His website, crimeresearch.org. And this is Zim in Columbia Falls, Montana. Good evening.
Hey, Jimbo, and to your great guest, Mr. Lott.
Thank you.
I've heard him on another national show, and being a cop retired now in California, I encountered many people outside of L.A. where I was a cop with guns, and I'll be doggone, none of them had a permit. It was just amazing, and he is exactly right about, you know, so-called politicians, whatever you want to call them, money and power, money and power. And, you know, this gun-free zone gig, if there just would have been one, just one person in that tragedy in Colorado, maybe it could have saved a few lives.
One would hope. Your thoughts, John?
No, I think he's exactly right. I mean, I mean there's so many points to what he's saying. I just mentioned in Colorado, the movie theater shooting, the Batman movie theater shooting there, you had seven movie theaters within a 20-minute drive of the killer's apartment. Only one of those posted signs banning permanent concealed handguns. The killer didn't go to the movie theater that was closest to his home. He didn't go to the movie theater that advertised itself prominently as having the largest auditoriums in the state of Colorado. Instead, he went to the single place that made it so victims couldn't defend themselves. But, you know, the officer's views there, I mean, you look at, you can go to our website at crimeresearch.org. I have links to a survey by Police One, as well as other surveys of police. Police One is the largest private organization of police officers in the United States. They have about 450,000 members. And they overwhelmingly agree with what the officer just said there, that police as a whole are probably the strongest single supporters of civilians being able to go and have guns. They realize how important gun ownership is for protecting themselves.
Now, that's worth thinking about a moment here. If, in fact, gun owners and people who carry guns are a major threat to the public and a major source of crime, the first people who will be hit by this crime wave would be those police officers. Now, what does that tell you?
Right. You know, and it fits in with what we talked about earlier about behavior permit holders. You talk to police officers, they're relieved. If they pull over a car and they call in, like in Virginia, you put in the license plate, they'll be told whether the owner of the car there is a permit holder. You talk to police officers, they're relieved to know that it's a permit holder that's there. They're not worried about it. The reason is because they know how incredibly law-abiding the permit holders are, and they realize that they're not going to have a problem with that individual that they just pulled over.
Let's take a call. Thank you, Zim, by the way, for your call, your listenership, and your service to your community. Let's go to Jimmy in Boston. Hello, Jimmy.
Hey, good evening, Jim. I moved from the city of Boston. I lived there my entire life. I was a Boston fireman, and I'm sure you're aware that we have the most, some of the most onerous laws here in the Commonwealth in Boston. And the only reason I got a permit was because I was a Boston fireman, you know, a captain. So they give me a Class A, it's called the top license, large magazine, and everything, but a restriction. I can't conceal and carry, or I can't open carry. So it's pretty much like a basic permit. So I moved to the city of Quincy, which is just south, you know, city of Presidents. I notify the police department here. They wouldn't give me a new one there, and they looked up the weapons that were stored at my sister's house. She's been licensed to carry longer than me. My house was raided without a warrant this past October. They took me outside. I was sick with pneumonia. My underwear entertained me while they searched the house.
You're a firefighter.
Because they thought
you're a public servant.
Yeah.
And one who puts his life on the line. That's outrageous.
It's called the suitability law. But that individual police officer designated in his mind can deem that you're not fit to have these weapons.
Right. You know, it is outrageous what's happened in Massachusetts.
Thanks, Jim.
Yes, sir.
They had the licensing rule went into effect in 1998, and legally owned guns in Massachusetts has fallen by 86% since then, because you have to go and get approval from the local police. And as he's saying, in Boston, it's basically impossible. Even retired police officers have an incredibly difficult time of being able to go own a gun, handgun afterwards. And but the interesting thing is that as you've seen the drop in gun ownership in Massachusetts, its violent crime rates have risen relative to its neighbors. I mean, the charts are very dramatic, that you would see like robbery was falling relative to the robbery rates in each of its neighbors prior to the licensing rule, and then afterwards it went up. It looks like a V. And for murder was relatively flat in Massachusetts compared to its neighbors right up until the licensing rule. And then as soon as it went into effect, Massachusetts murder rates started rising relative to its neighbors.
Stay with us. More to come on the Bohannon Show. We'll be back with more calls with John Lott in just a moment.
Hey, it's Jimmy Fallon. Here's what's happening later on the Tonight Show. Here's what people are talking about. Of course, it's this freezing, frigid weather. It's ice cold. Oh, my gosh. In the Northeast, it's just ice cold. In fact, I read that officials are worried that all the snow and freezing temperatures could really put a strain on hospitals. Not now, but in 9 months when every woman in Boston is giving birth at the same time. We can't go outside, Brian. Let's do it. Some political news, guys. Chris Christie addressed recent stories about his change in personality and said there's only one Chris Christie. Yeah, he said the only time there are two Chris Christies is when he's buying seats on a plane. And that's the only time you'll see that. That's the only time. And finally, a pretty sweet story here. I heard about a man who in New Jersey has written one love letter every day to his wife since 1975. And he signs every letter with the phrase, "I love you, my darling," and the symbol for infinity. And this is sweet. His wife responds to every letter with a text message that says, "K." Catch the Tonight Show tonight on NBC.
Welcome back. This is the Jim Bohannon Show. Our guest is John Lott. He's president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, the website crimeresearch.org. And this is Joey in Columbia, South Carolina. Good evening, Joey.
Hey, Jimbo, good show. Going to keep me up again tonight.
All good.
Thank you, Mr. Lott, for what you do. I really got two questions. I'll do it quick, and I'll hang up if I can get it in. You kind of answered one of them about the, you know, I would like to know where can I find any stats where guns have actually stopped crimes. But you can, I'll listen after this question. Being that the Second Amendment and the right of ownership of firearms, and I'm in South Carolina, why don't I have my South Carolina protections in other states? And what the issue I have is I like to travel up and down 95, and it's like arcane trying to look and see what you got to do for each state to transport a loaded weapon in your vehicle. And any advice, or has there ever been any legislation to protect me, a South Carolinian, in, say, Massachusetts? I mean, I know I would never do that. I mean, I don't even know. I would never go up there with a gun in my car. Probably get arrested, but I'll listen off air. Thank you, Jim.
All right. Very good. I have somewhere, and I really ought to get a new copy because the laws change all the time, but it's a list of the gun laws of all 50 states. And if you travel like Joey does, John,
right,
you'd better get a copy of that thing because, let me tell you something, crossing state line, and you might go from law-abiding citizen to felon waiting to be caught.
Sure. I mean, there are some protections, but, you know, so you're allowed to travel through states, but, you know, you're kind of at the mercy of the local authorities, whether, you know, they feel, you know, have you traveled straight through? Did you stop and visit somebody? But there is some good news on the horizon. There is a bill that's before the Senate that would have it so that concealed carry licenses would be recognized in different states in the same way that driver's licenses are today. You'd have to go and follow the rules in the individual state, but once you had a license in South Carolina, you'd be able to go and take your permanent concealed handgun with you across the country. There are a number of states right now who have reciprocity. So, like, if you have a permit in Tennessee, for example, I think there's like 40 states that recognize it, and you have many other states that have similar types of recognition between the different states. But John Cornyn, the senator from
Texas,
has a bill up right now. It came very close to passing in the Senate before. It had 57 votes. It needs to get 60 to get over the filibuster that's there. And with this last election, it should be pretty close with the Republican control of the Senate. The House has been able to pass it easily before, but of course, the president will likely veto it, but I think there's a good chance at least now we'll get through the Senate.
And I gather that the caller wanted some information about, I guess, specificity of guns actually stopping crime.
Right. Well, there are different ways that this is measured. I suppose the simplest thing is just there are surveys that are done. We don't know a lot of crimes that are committed against people. For example, the federal government. How do we know that half of rapes are reported? Well, the way we know that is we know what crimes are reported to police, but then they go and do surveys of people to try to find out whether the rate at which rapes are committed. And the same type of thing is done with regard to gun crimes. So we have about 250,000 gun crimes are committed each year. We use surveys to both find out the number of gun crimes, which is probably closer to 400,000, and also the rate at which people use guns defensively. And those surveys indicate it's about 2 million times a year that people use guns defensively. So that's about 4 to 5 times more frequently that people use guns to stop crime than to commit it. But there's other types of research that's done. Things that are a little bit more complicated are things to look at what happens to crime rates as you have increases in the percentage of the adult population with concealed carry permits.
All right. We're going to have to wrap on that note. Stay on the line. We'll speak off air. But again, you can learn more at the website crimeresearch.org. That's the website of the Crime Prevention Research Center. John Lott, our guest, is the president of that group. And this is a story we'll be talking about many times in the future. I'm Jim Bohannon on Westwood One. evening. Welcome to the Jimbo Hannon Show from Westwood One Radio. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Online, you'll find us at jimbotalk.net. Follow me on Twitter at Jimbo Talks. We're going to be talking tonight about the latest regarding the Copenhagen attack, terrorism in Europe and elsewhere. And also we'll discuss the possibility of a connection between the American left and Islamic extremism, which, if so, is certainly ironic in view of the fact that people who hold the views of the American left would be the very first targets of Islamic extremism. It is hard to imagine anything more oil and water than those two, at least logically speaking. We're talking tonight with John Guandolo. He is a former FBI special agent and counterterrorism expert and graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy and a Marine officer who served in the Gulf War. And he's the founder of UnderstandTheThreat.com. John, good evening.
Good evening. Thanks for having me again.
Absolutely. Glad to have you back on the program tonight. First of all, what have you learned that the rest of us should have learned regarding some of the attacks that took place in Copenhagen, Denmark?
Well, the key, I think, that we need to take away again is that the series of attacks that we've witnessed over the years, this being the latest one, is all about the Islamic law of slander. And that comes cloaked in a term that most people have heard, Islamophobia. But if I could just take a minute, maybe walk your audience through this. I know that we discussed it a little last time, so I think you're up on it. But I just, this is really important because this is a huge portion of their strategy internationally. And essentially, I could boil it down to this. It's the ability to say, be quiet or else. And we saw that with the Charlie Hebdo murders. We've seen that in other places. We certainly have even seen it here in the United States, that when, you know, even during the original Muhammad cartoon, what I will call the press called it the Muhammad cartoon crisis, you know, bookstores, including Barnes and Nobles and Borders, you know, put out official comments from corporate headquarters saying we've decided not to, you know, carry any magazines or publications with these cartoons because we fear for the safety of our employees. That is the Islamic law of slander, which says you may not say anything about Islam that a Muslim would dislike. And these guys quote the Prophet Muhammad himself, who said anyone who slanders the Prophet or Islam, faqtuluhum, kill him. And that's what you're seeing. You're seeing people doing that all over the world. And how this manifests itself in this war is we are not, because of the pressure from the major Islamic groups in the United States, we are not even training our law enforcement and military in the things they need to be trained in on these issues, because the largest Islamic groups are screaming that it's racist and bigoted and Islamophobic. And so what we see in this attack in Copenhagen is just that. You've got a filmmaker who's killed and another who is obviously there and several other people. It's all about free speech. This is a direct assault on the free speech to speak truth into this threat. And this is a major line of attack globally, for the global Islamic movement.
1-866-50-JIMBO is our number. 1-866-505-4626. How do you counter something like that? Despite the fact that I would admit that there's something rather craven about the decision of stores to do that, but it's certainly understandable from the standpoint of protecting the employees. I frankly don't think that justifies it, but I can understand the reasoning. But when you give into something like that, you have essentially acquiesced. You might as well get out in the street and start shouting Islamist slogans. You've given in. As the old line goes, it's a cliche, but in this case, yeah, the terrorists have won.
You're exactly right, but I think you're more on the mark than you realize. That is the intention of this policy. is to shut down any free discussion about this enemy, which they have done in the United States for a number of years now. And when they say, like, for instance, when you ask what should they do, they should put the cartoons out. They should, people should stand up and speak the truth. And, you know, there's nobody I know certainly at the international level that's doing it, but even here in the United States who hasn't been threatened by the groups, either here, the Hamas groups in the United States or from outside the United States. And so security measures have to be taken. But are we willing, for the sake of our own immediate safety, willing to surrender one of the bedrock principles of Western civilization?
No. I'll answer that right now emphatically. No. I mean, it is high time that somebody held this dog crap under the nose of the people who have been dumping this and simply point out some unfortunate but true facts, and that is that Islam has a serious cancer growing on it, but even those parts of Islam which are peaceful are still living in a dark ages mentality. The notion if you convert to another faith, you should be killed. That makes you a savage if you believe that. That makes you beneath the contempt of civilized people. The idea that one may not utter any criticism of this or that religion makes you a savage. You are beneath contempt. I'm sorry, but at some point somebody, and I'm sure as hell, and I'm not talking about the current president of the United States, somebody has got to stand up and say this. Islam has got to undergo a reformation if they have any hopes of joining the 20th century. And I did not say 21st. They're not even ready to join the 20th yet. But maybe if they make it that far, we might think about admitting them to the 21st century. It's just, it's got to be said. And that is not Islamophobia. Yes, there are many fine Muslims in the world. Yes, many who do not go around and shoot or bomb or do anything else. But they are, in far too many cases, acquiescing to this presence. This is a cancer that has got to be stamped out. And I just fail to understand how anybody thinks that this will get any better by trying to pussyfoot around the subject. It's not going to get better.
Yeah, and you know, if you want to, that's well said. If you want to look at the internal struggle, you've got two, not our president, but two leaders in King Abdullah of Jordan and President al-Sisi in Egypt. You know, that when people say things like, but these guys are doing things that are un-Islamic, that's simply untrue. And you just said it. They have to decide whether they're going to be in the civilized world or in a barbaric world. And al-Sisi himself, the president of Egypt, when he lambasted the Islamic scholars at Al-Azhar, the most prominent school of Islamic jurisprudence in the world and the oldest, it's the gold standard, and there's really no close second place, he said, we have to think, I'm going to just read this, we have to think hard about what we are facing. It's inconceivable that the thinking that we hold most should cause the entire Ummah, the Islamic world, to be a source of anxiety, danger, killing, and destruction for the rest of the world. You know, he is saying, I understand that these things that are happening are within the teachings of Islam, but we have to reject it. We can't go into the modern world like this. And the problem is that the next day, several of these scholars condemned al-Sisi and said, this is apostasy. You cannot talk like this. And of course, when a scholar calls somebody an apostate, that the penalty for that is death.
And well, then good. In that case, the penalty for the person who declares that particular fatwa should be death as well. We're going to have to exterminate a lot of these thug mullahs. And I'm not talking about every Yahoo with a 30-odd six. I'm talking about officially sanctioned state action. But you have a lot of people in this world are supposed religious leaders who are thugs in clerical garb. Yeah, you want a fatwa? Well, fatwa this, Sonny. This is a call from Justin in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Good evening.
Hey, good evening. How you doing?
Fine, thank you.
That's good. All this talk about, you know, what's going on with ISIS across the ocean and whatever, and they could get here. Well, we got to get our own house in order before we can go even over there. I mean, we got millions of people pouring across this border and telling us to change our own laws.
Well, I think that it's quite possible that we can walk and chew gum at the same time. And while I certainly don't for a moment dispute the importance of what you're saying, there's nothing that is makes it necessary to do that to the exclusion of anything else. We should be working on several fronts, and that's one of them. I defer to John here. Go ahead, John.
Well, I appreciate the comment. I think we can do more than one thing at once. A professional and a thoughtful government could do that. But the caller brings up a good point, and that is we know for a fact this opens up a broad discussion, but just a couple quick points. We know, for instance, in South America, you've got Iran, Hezbollah, and Iranian Revolutionary Guard forces working with Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Muslim Brotherhood, working with cartels and human traffickers to get people across the border. We know that that's going on. We've certainly briefed that to leadership. This is not it shouldn't be a secret at this point that that's going on. So the fact that we have not gained control of our borders, you know, no civilization, no society can survive unless it protects its borders, and we're no exception.
But good point, Justin. We do need to do that, but we don't need to stop doing everything else. 1-866-50-JIMBO is our number, 1-866-505-4626. We'll come back and we'll talk some more with John Guandolo, his thoughts about the connection between the American left and Islamic extremism, and about that presidential summit on extremism as well, when we come back in just a moment. Thanks for being with us on the Jimbo Hanna Show tonight. We're talking with former FBI agent, former Marine veteran from the Gulf War, John Guandolo. He's the author of Raising a Jihadi Generation. More about that in a moment as well. Right now, Eddie in Reading, Pennsylvania. Good evening, Eddie.
Hey, I wanted to talk about everybody. A lot of people say how we're against Islam, but they don't state the fact that Islam is against the Jews and they're spreading anti-Semitism.
Some are. Let's be clear about this. Not every Muslim in the world necessarily believes that.
I go along with that, but it's not the Christian community that's spreading it now. It's the radical Muslims that are spreading it.
I would agree that in terms of the major source of, not the only source, but the major source of anti-Semitism in the world, yes, would be militant Islam.
Right, I don't hear anybody saying about anything about that. It's always that we're against the Muslims, and we're picking on the Muslim
religion. Well, anybody who says that we're against all Muslims is either a simplistic idiot or somebody who has an agenda and is trying to sell this to a lot of people. John?
Well, I think a couple things. One of the problems, and this is why I have tried to share this over the years, it's very important. It's important that we understand who the enemy, how they identify themselves, and what that means, and then what about the people that don't subscribe to jihad or Sharia? First of all, the enemy we're facing unequivocally states they're Muslims waging jihad in the cause of Allah to impose Sharia, Islamic law, and establish the Islamic State, the caliphate. At the first grade level in Islamic schools and masjids across the globe, that's what's taught. Because that's what Islamic law requires. That's why it's taught at the most preeminent schools of Islamic jurisprudence in the world. And there's no such thing as a version of Islam that doesn't teach that. So when we analyze it from a national security standpoint, we need to start there. That said, there are Muslims. I worked with them in the FBI. I work with them now at the local level who do not subscribe to that. And they do not subscribe to slaughtering people as we're seeing. The problem is because it's taught at a very young age, there is a lot of this that's accepted because it is what Islam teaches. Very courageous men like President al-Sisi of Egypt who stand up and say, look, I get that this is what Islam is. You know, he's a Muslim. He's a president of a large Muslim country. But he's saying, but we have to stop this. we have to have a, he called it, we have to have a revolution within Islam. He's fighting an uphill battle, but that's courageous. So the delineation when I speak to law enforcement has to be Sharia. If somebody seeks, if somebody is adherent to Sharia, which you can, there are many ways to discern that, and they seek to impose it on others, they are a threat to this republic, and they need to be treated as such.
Yeah, and there just can't be any mincing words about this, this notion of playing politically correct. Well, let me ask your thoughts regarding the president's summit on terrorism and extremism, which is now entering, I guess, its final day this coming day.
Well, it's very interesting. There's so much to say about that, Jim. I'm not sure how long we can go on. But
I'll interrupt you when we're out of time, but go ahead.
Well, the first thing is the title of the conference is actually Countering Violent Extremism. Now, as I just shared, the enemy we're facing, whether they call themselves ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah, Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, Abu Sayyaf, or one of the other hundreds and hundreds of jihadi organizations, or it's the Muslim Brotherhood, Tabliki Jamaat, Jamaati Islami, the major Islamic movements in the world right now, the most preeminent one or prominent one is the Muslim Brotherhood. They don't call themselves violent extremists. They call themselves jihadis, waging jihad. And when the Attorney General just said in an interview, he goes, I don't know why everyone's all wrapped up with what we call them, radicals or this or that. It doesn't matter. Well, it does matter because we are now in 2015, many years after 9/11, and to date, our national security apparatus has not identified the enemy we're facing in any national security documents, none. This enemy, you know, our war-fighting doctrine, I mean, you're a warrior, Jim. You know this with your service history. Our war-fighting doctrine says when we analyze an enemy, you begin with who they say they are and why they're fighting, and then you go from there. We've never done that since 9/11, 2001, and it's why we lost the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, even though our military crushed the enemy on the battlefield. And these defeats are going to be, we're going to see more of them, and we're going to see more increased violence, because until you look at this from how they see the world and you understand what their defeat mechanism is, in other words, how we get them in a position where they know they're defeated so they stop, we are going to be in for a very rough ride.
Yes. I think we certainly are. 1-866-50-JIMBO is our number, 1-866-505-4626, and more to come as we continue our discussion with former FBI special agent and counterterrorism expert John Guandolo. He is the founder of Understanding the Threat. That is understandingthethreat.com. It's an organization dedicated to providing threat-focused strategic and operational consultation, education, and training for federal, state, and local leadership and agencies. Again, our number 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. As it's time to stop wallowing in euphemisms and speak clearly. Back in a moment. Welcome back to the Jimbo Hannon Show as we're talking with John Guandolo, former FBI special agent, counterterrorism expert, author of Raising a Jihadi Generation. As we take some more calls, I would note one thing about the many Muslims who have left the Arabic and other parts of the Middle East, the Arabic world. They're looking for a better life. They're looking for less state intrusion. They are looking for job opportunities. And then the minute they get where they're going, they promptly bring with them the very infestation that caused their homeland to be such a terrible place to live. You might want to keep in mind that an open society is what creates those jobs that you want so much. And that means an open society. It does not mean open unless, of course, we shut our mouths about someone who may or may not criticize your faith. You're going to have to make up your mind. In short, think about joining the 20th century with an option on the 21st. All right, Mike in Brookline, Massachusetts. Good evening.
Thanks, Jim. I want to thank you, guests, for your service to our country.
Thank you.
As a Marine and as an FBI special agent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My question is this. Sir, is there an influence on our college campuses of Muslim extremism? Are you aware of any? Because I hear sometimes that there's a very ongoing influence on our college campuses. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Thank you, sir, and thanks for your kind words. There's a tremendous effort by the Islamic movement here in the United States. Maybe I'll just give a quick 30-second download so people understand kind of where I'm coming from on this. There were a couple major terrorism trials in the last 8 to 10 years, the largest being something called the United States versus Holy Land Foundation trial in Dallas in 2008. And that was a over 15-year FBI investigation, and much of the evidence came from several major events. One was a 1993 meeting of Hamas leaders in the United States that the FBI covered. They put microphones in meeting rooms and phone calls and did physical surveillance. And another one was in 2004 where the FBI raided a home in Annandale, Virginia, and discovered the archives of the Muslim Brotherhood and thousands of documents and strategic plans and financial records and lists of leaders and audio and videotapes. It was a tremendous gold mine. Well, a lot of that went into evidence in this Holy Land Foundation trial, which was the largest terrorism financing and Hamas trial ever successfully prosecuted in American history. And the implications of that trial are this. The evidence demonstrated that the largest and most prominent Islamic organizations in America are part of the Muslim Brotherhood's movement here. Today in the United States, there are over 2,100 Islamic centers, mosques, in all 50 states, and a large portion of those are part of the Muslim Brotherhood's network. We have, to your point, the very first Muslim Brotherhood organization created in the United States also just happened to be the first national Islamic organization created in America. The Muslim Students Association in 1963 at the University of Illinois in Urbana. And today there are over 630 chapters in all 50 states on every major college campus, and they are a focal point for recruitment and for the jihad. And they are allowed to exist, and university presidents and others defend them because they say they're nice, and yet when they show up to events,
they're nice.
I hear that a lot. They can't be bad people because I've met them, I've talked to them, and they're nice. And what you get is you get them doing things, and I'll just give you a handful of examples. You know, we saw them a couple of years ago at the University the Ohio State University, walking across the stage wearing Hamas colors and chanting. You see them in places like out at UCSD and in other places where they refuse to denounce Hezbollah or Hamas. And they hold fundraisers for organizations that support Hamas and Hezbollah. This kind of stuff, by the way, some of it is against the law. We have a number of people who are prominent jihadis who have been leaders in the Muslim Student Association, not the least of which Anwar al-Awlaki, the al-Qaeda leader from Yemen who we killed in 2011 with a missile. We've got all kinds of guys. And just that they're you can see some of their programs on YouTube and just listen to what comes out of their mouths. It's vile. It's anti-Semitic. It's anti-American. It's anti-constitutional republic. And it's pro-Hamas, pro-Hezbollah. I mean, what do you think they're doing? They're telling you who they are, and the fact that they're Muslim Brotherhood organization is really all you need to know.
Oh, you Islamophobe you. Well, let's take a call from Cynthia in Phoenix. Good evening, Cynthia.
Good evening. I have a question. You were talking just before the break about understanding the enemy and understanding what causes them, what's the root of what they're fighting for. And I wondered if you could help me remember a few years ago, not that, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, when we were still in Iraq, there was a, I think it was a general who came out, he was very high up in the administration, but he was speaking at private organizations about the fact that this was a spiritual battle that was being fought, not just in the natural, but at a spiritual level. And he was really uncovering some things that I think were profound and real, because there are that element in what's going on. Part of their whole purpose, I believe, is what they believe from their, obviously from their historical, religious and spiritual beliefs. So, could you remind me, do you remember that, and do you remember who that, I think it was a general, who that was?
I don't personally recall. Do you, John?
Well, I think who you're talking about is Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, who was pushed out of the Pentagon because of his comments, and quite frankly, he was absolutely correct. He spoke very frankly. Now, this is a guy, just as a matter of, so we put this into perspective, this isn't just any, you know, three-star general. This was a guy who was one of the founding members of the U.S. Army's Delta. He became the commander of Delta. He became the commander of the U.S. Special Forces Command and the commandant of the JFK Special Operations Center in Fort Bragg. And he was also the deputy director of the CIA Special Activities before he was the deputy undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence. So this is no piker we're talking about. And he was the commander of Delta during the Battle of Mogadishu. So a couple of things you said there I'd like to comment about. First of all, he does get it. He spoke very clearly that the problem is has its roots in Islam. That in fact, you know, I spoke to a four-star general a few years ago, who was a very senior commander. And, my question to him was, sir, are you aware that when Al-Qaeda quotes Islamic law, they've never misquoted Islamic law in furtherance of what they do? And his response was, well, if that's true, then we would have to completely change the nature of the way we're fighting this war. And, that is true.
And that may be the reason why there's so much denial, because we would have to change the nature.
That's right. We have to address it. And again, you can't discuss, like people ask me, well, so what you're saying is we'd have to do this. And I'm saying, well, actually, I didn't say that. What I'm saying is before we can have any discussion about how we're going to deal with the issue, you actually have to know the issue. And General Boykin, oddly enough, is also the guy who at last week's Defeat Jihad Summit that was I actually participated in Washington, D.C., he said when the president was bringing up the AUMF, the authorization for the use of military force against ISIS, his comment was, of course we should not approve it, and nobody should even look at it until we define who is the threat. Because if we say ISIS is the threat, then the next logical question is, well, what about Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah, Boko Haram? What about them? What about the Muslim Brotherhood? What about Iran? What are we doing with those? So is it we just have not defined the enemy in any way whatsoever. So that's a lengthy
answer to your question. But very, very worthwhile. More calls to come. Stay with us. Back in just a moment. Welcome back. This is the Jim Bohannon Show, and our guest is former FBI agent John Guandolo, and he is the man behind the website understandingthethreat.com. One word, understandingthethreat.com. And we're talking about the ways in which we deal or the ways in which we pretend that we're dealing with Islamic extremism. Let's go to Lou in Watertown, New York. Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Hi, as a matter of fact, I just, compliment you on your accomplishments, and I agree with pretty much every point that you've made. Understanding the enemy is a real weird thing to do. That's a real hard thing to do, excuse me. It's because you don't know. Well, I mean, in a foreign country, I've been in a foreign country, and it's just you can't conceive, who is the threat and who is not.
Well, sometimes you can, and sometimes it's more difficult, but you can at the very least make efforts in that direction. Sometimes it's not as hard as it may initially appear.
Correct. Sometimes it's direct to the point, and sometimes it's not. So,
okay.
But as far as closing the borders and stuff like that, now I've known a lot of people, as far as immigrants and everything like that. There's good people and bad people.
Mm-hmm.
In every race and whatever
right.
you want to call.
We will take that as a given.
Pretty much.
But so what point are we arriving at here?
As far as the Hamas, Islamic situation is just kind of like they teach them from young boys since they're in the cradle.
Well, a lot of people, yes, and we can't spend a whole lot of time wandering, Lou, but suffice it to say, yes, in many parts of the world, especially in the Middle East, even people who don't wind up actually committing such actions are taught from an early age, and I'd like your thoughts about that, John Guandolo, and also the extent to which in mosques in this country, young people are taught the same thing, to hate infidels, Jews, Christians, what have you, killing your enemy is a proper religious function. I think we pretty much accepted that happens elsewhere in the world. Does it happen here, particularly in Wahhabi-funded mosques?
Yes. Yes. We know, as a matter of fact, through both property records, who owns the property, as well as the leaders of the Islamic centers and masjids, mosques in the United States, that most of them, and when I say most, well over 70%, are Muslim Brotherhood entities, and therefore they're teaching exactly what Al-Qaeda is saying. And you're not going to get a watered-down version of that, and that's a problem. That's a big problem. And again, back to the kind of, what I think is the important point here is, if you don't understand, no, not everybody is that goes, like you just said, that goes through these are going to pop up and shoot people. However, when you're ingrained with this from the time you're 4 or 5, and those are the mosques or Islamic centers you're going to are teaching that, which we know that most of them in America are, then that's the cauldron from which these guys are going to come, and we have to recognize that. I think it requires drastic action on the part of our government. And I agree with what you said earlier. This cannot be vigilantism. Our government has a responsibility for the safety and security not only of its citizens, but of the republic itself. And they have allowed a huge cancer to grow inside this country. And until we deal with it, well, we could do it legally. You could shut down, you could indict many of these organizations with the evidence already on the table tomorrow. But there seems to be no willingness on the part of the Department of Justice and the White House to actually do that. And therein lies the big questions of why is
yeah.
that?
Oh, if we're nice enough and self-effacing enough and apologetic enough, they'll see the error of their ways and they'll love us. Bill in Cleveland, good evening.
Good evening. My question for Mr. Guandolo is, would the Islamic threat, particularly in the Middle East, have grown as fast as it has had we not toppled Saddam Hussein and not helped topple Gaddafi with our bombing campaign in Libya?
All right. Interesting thoughts. What are your feelings about that, John?
Sir, that is a great question. And I would say the answer is no, it would not have. But we did those things because we had no idea what we were doing. We initiated campaigns based on a false assumption that the events of 9/11 had nothing to do with Islam, And so we looked at, well, they're getting safe haven in Iraq, which was true. There's WMD in Iraq, which we, of course, now know is very true. We've now found all kinds of stuff there.
As a matter of fact, for those who think that that is mythology, John is absolutely correct. They had weapons of mass destruction out the wazoo.
Yes.
Even the New York Times admitted that.
But when you look at the threat strategically, I think it was a mistake. Saddam Hussein was an evil man, but at least for the time being, he was keeping the Muslim Brotherhood and the Sunni jihadis at bay. So was Muammar Gaddafi, by the way. And, oh, by the way, this administration provided material support to al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood, which we said they were rebels, but we knew they were al-Qaeda and Muslim Brotherhood, who were fighting in Libya and Iraq and now in Syria. So, which, by the way, is a violation of U.S. law, but let's not let that get in the way.
Right.
You know, there's the answer.
Fair enough. We'll take a break and take some more calls when we come back. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show. By the way, our guest John Wandolo has very graciously agreed to extend into the next hour, so we'll try to get to your call even if the break comes up in this hour. Sharon in Crane, Missouri. Hello.
Hello, Jim. I'd like to make 2 points. I realize that all Muslims are not jihadists and they are not extremists, just as all Christians are not extremists. You can say that about any religion, but the Muslims who do not subscribe to the belief of the Islamic terrorists need to stand up and declare themselves. Second, the president today was very quick about talking about how the roots of all of this is in hopelessness and no jobs for all of these young people. Well, if I had been an American black person, young black person, and I will not call them African Americans, they are Americans. If I had been one of those young people listening to the president today, I would have been so angry, steam would have been coming off of me. They are sitting there in cities with an unemployment rate that is unbelievably high. And the president does nothing but pay lip service to the problem while they're being involved in gangs and being shot and being killed and being put in prison.
All right, interesting thought, Sharon. In the time we have left here, want to get some answers from John. First of all, I'm trying to imagine what would happen if a significant portion, let's say 10% of Catholics or 10% of Baptists in this country, started conducting terror campaigns. Are you kidding me? They would need the law to protect them from being lynched by their fellow church members. Where are the Muslims? Why are they not running these clowns out of the mosques?
Right. Well, so that's interesting. And you hear people when you start talking about Islam, some of the first things I always hear is, oh, but there are violent Christians too, and there are violent passages in the Bible. And I just shut them down and say, well, first of all, if you actually know what you're talking about, we're talking about it's not even apples and oranges. The doctrine of Islam mandates jihad until the entire world is under Sharia, and there's no such thing as a version of Islam that's not that. That's why they teach it at the first grade in all the Islamic schools around the world.
All right. Keep your head of steam going, okay? We're going to have to do that after the break. Stay on the line. We'll continue our conversation with John Wandolo. Again, he is the man who's the author of Raising a Jihadi Generation. And we've got more to come. Stay with us right here. I'm Jim Bohannon, and this is Westwood One. Hi there, and good evening, good morning. Welcome to the Jimbo Hannon Show from Westwood One Radio. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Online, you'll find us at jimbotalk.net. Follow me on Twitter, at Jimbo Talks, as we are continuing our discussion from the previous hour with John Guandolo, former FBI special agent, the author of Raising a Jihadi Generation, and the man behind the website UnderstandingTheThreat.com. And Sharon in Crane, Missouri, had been asking you about some of the comparisons made between Christianity and Islam. Let's do that before we take some more calls.
Yeah, I just wanted to finish that point, is that in Christianity, there's no such doctrine that violence is a perpetual command from God. As a matter of fact, Jesus boiled down the entire law of Moses, the Ten Commandments, specifically into love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and spirit, and love your neighbor, which it also intones that we love ourselves. That's Christian teaching. There is no such idea in Islam as a loving God, the way we understand it, a fatherly God. He is the ultimate lawgiver. He's given the law. He's given the Sharia, and Muslims are commanded to obey it. That's it. And so when we hear, you know, the examples I was given before the break, when you see them, they stand, thousands of them, marching with huge signs that say, you know, wage jihad. It is a command from Allah. Death to those who insult Islam. Behead those who insult Islam. They do it in huge crowds in places like London and Paris and other European countries. They've done it here certainly Florida was one of the biggest ones when, you know, they were shouting, Jews, go back to your ovens. So I'm not sure what the confusion is when we see everything happening. We've got our leaders, our president and vice president. I mean, the vice president said not that long ago, it's just a handful of nuts. I mean, at what point, you know, I asked a question today during another interview. I think this is a sign that there is a serious mental illness on the case of the president. If he's not intentionally aiding our enemies, for which he should be impeached, well, then I think somebody ought to look at, pulling the constitutional punt guard that he's not fit for office. I mean, this is a complete disconnect from reality, what we're experiencing here, in my professional opinion. But.
Well, disconnect from reality is a very common affliction in this country, unfortunately, at the highest levels of power. Mary Beth calls in from Kutztown, Pennsylvania. Good evening.
Hi, good evening. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Thank you, John, for your service and your educating us on these issues. I guess I just want to say that from what I'm understanding you're saying and the facts is that there is no cohesive solution or agreement to the strategy that we need to be taking between the lawmakers and the military. Is that correct?
That's correct. And again, I think the reason is because nobody's agreed on what the threat is. That's the number one problem.
Okay. So why do you think that is? Do you think it's because there's an error with our lawmakers? It's everybody has to be right, or they're not looking at what truth is? I'm just wondering, what is truth? In other words, if I go to your website, and I'm not doubting it, but if I go to your website and I educate myself on this and I teach others and I ask others to look at the website and I contact my lawmakers, how do I know that what is truth? In other words, we have the president saying this is truth, we have this person saying this is truth, and you know, if we don't understand what the truth is, then how can we take drastic action?
All right. You keep in mind, Mary, a couple of things here. Truth can be determined by fact. For example, some of the things that have been said by the president and the vice president cannot explain away gatherings such as the one in Florida that were just outlined by John Guandolo, pardon me, they're not just a handful of nuts, unfortunately. I wish that it were. Certainly the ones who have engaged in actual action are in this country so far a minority, but when you actually march and profess that you believe this stuff, then how far are you from doing what it is you say is right and proper and God's will? How far indeed? How far is society supposed to pretend that you won't go? And I would add one more thing before John replies, and that would be this. There are a lot of people whose entire worldview is based on the knowledge, or I should say on the precept, that all of us deep down inside are really reasonable. There are no rights and wrongs. There are no cases of extreme moral clarity. It's all just a continuum. That's not true. Demonstrably not true. Look at history. Look at the people around you. There are people out there who are fanatics who firmly believe that it is right to kill you if you don't submit to Islam. Don't dismiss that. And people who do, I would dismiss as crackpots too, but unfortunately we keep electing them to high positions of power in this country. I'll defer to John Guandolo here.
Well, Jim, you just actually laid the framework for part of my answer. Thank you for the question. There is objective truth. I mean, you can say there's no such thing as gravity and then just go up to a third-story building and step off and pretty much there's your objective truth right there. 2 + 2 = 4. Now, I say that. I'm not saying that tongue-in-cheek. I've actually heard somebody, I've used that when somebody has said to me, there's no such thing as objective truth, and my response was 2 + 2 = 4. And they said, well, you know, it doesn't always have to be that way.
In this universe, it does.
That's right. I mean, at some point, you have to realize some people are just not living in reality. But here's two things. You just mentioned the word reason. This enemy is very astute at strategic planning and long-range strategic operations. A big part of their plan includes, just like it did with the communist movement and the progressive movement, the destruction of reason, the destruction of discerning thought. And, you know, some people call it the dumbing down of America. These are not just happenstance. If you look at what's happened in the last 40 years in our educational system, these are not happenstance. You can track them all back. I'm not going to walk it all back, but these are thoughtful, planned out strategies to weaken us, because the strength of the West has always been freedom of discussion, freedom of thought, reasoned thinking, because that is what keeps free people free, a big part of it. When we talk about, when you say, what is the truth? Here is the truth, and there is this is, I'm going to lay it out, is that there's no such thing as any authoritative published Islamic law that does not oblige jihad until the entire world is ruled by Islamic law. Doesn't exist, never has. That is why that is taught at the first grade level and certainly at the junior high and high school level, the Islamic schools all over the world. That is what Al-Azhar, the preeminent school of Islamic thought and jurisprudence, because these are not imams, are not priests, pastors, and rabbis. They're Islamic legal scholars, because this is a legal system. This is what it is. So when someone says, well, I don't know, I don't believe that, that's not true, I'd say pick an Islamic bookstore anywhere on the planet, walk in there and buy any of the books they have on the shelf, buy 10 of them on Islamic law, and you'll go home, spend a month looking through them, and you'll see that they all say the exact same thing, which is the exact same thing it says in the elementary school textbooks. They're just, the language is softened a little bit. So that's what it is. That's what doctrinal Islam is. What your friend who's a Muslim says, or what a Muslim Brotherhood leader says to you when he talks to you, has no bearing on what the doctrine is. First of all, the Muslim Brotherhood's own Sharia obliges them to lie to you if the goal is obligatory, and jihad is obligatory. So anything that furthers the jihad obliges them to lie to you. And if you know you're talking to a leader of a Muslim Brotherhood Islamic Society or Islamic Center, then you know what you're, or the Islamic Society of North America or CARE or ICNA or the Muslim American Society or the Muslim Public Affairs Council or the Muslim Students Association, then you know what you got. This is not rocket science, because if it were, I wouldn't be the messenger here. This is stuff that is locked down, and there is no disagreement among any Islamic scholars since the 10th century. This has been locked down.
1-866-50-JIMBO, as we go to Robert in Suffield, Ohio. Hello.
Good evening. I certainly am enjoying the show tonight, Jim. It's this man is so very knowledgeable, and I'm getting quite an education, and I agree with him 150%. I can't tell you how much I'm waiting to hear somebody like this. But one thing that, you know, provokes me, too, what he just got through saying about these people being educated, I'd like to know what the percent of the people of this country paid for, the taxpayers paid for in grants to educate these people who are now trying to destroy us.
Good question. All right, let's address that, John.
Now, that is that's a fantastic question. Those numbers are significantly high. I mean, up until, let's see, about 4 years, 3 years ago, we had about 40,000 student visas for Saudis alone. That's a huge number. And many of them were getting government assistance through various programs. You've got the refugee resettlement program, which is bringing people from what I would call hostile countries like Syria, Somalia, into the United States by the tens of thousands. It actually has for a number of years now. Many of them come as students as well. And of course, we know that these are coming from countries that are not friendly to us.
Mm-hmm.
I think this question also begs something else we haven't talked about, and that is our counterintelligence apparatus in the United States is truly broken, and we do not treat counterintelligence threats the way we should. And as a matter of fact, I really, when I say broken, I mean broken. The idea that we would allow, I'll just run some of these by you. The idea that the previous assistant director for the FBI's Weapons of Mass Destruction Directorate was an Iranian-born Muslim. The fact that we have people in senior leadership positions in the government appointed in key positions that are in advisory roles that we can directly tie to Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas organizations wearing suits, working with the Secretary of State and the previous Secretary of State and the previous Secretary of State, and advising us, which would explain why we are creating policies that are having no impact, because we are allowing the enemy to help produce those. These kinds of things, not to mention the fact that we allow Chinese scientists pretty much free rein, and we're doing open scientific exchange with the Chinese. And the only people the Chinese government are allowing to come here are obviously people that they've got working for them.
There is a long, long list. We will take some more calls when we come back after these messages. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show. Our guest is former FBI agent John Guandolo. He is the author of a book that says a lot, Raising a Jihadi Generation. He's behind the website understandingthethreat.com. 1-866-50-JIMBO is our number, and this is Tommy in Charleston, West Virginia. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Bohannon. Could say a good deal on this issue, but I want to ask a simple question. I think it's in everyone's best interest. ISIL, this organization, which has caused so much pain recently, what, if anything, is being done to choke off their access to revenue, cash money, or otherwise in form of supplies, ordnance, and you know, significant equipment, rifles, etc.
All right. I can give you part of that answer. They took over a lot of banks in western Iraq and eastern Syria, and they also control a fair amount of oil. And you'll always, when you've got cash, which they've got, you are always going to be able to buy weaponry. But, John?
Yeah, that's a good portion of the answer, Jim, that you just said there. You've also got funding channels that are coming from nation states that are supporting this. And that's true with Al-Qaeda, with Hamas, with all of them. I mean, last year, the number one funder for Hamas was Iran, and that's a Shia nation funding a Sunni terrorist organization. That's the way it works. Without breaking into a broader discussion, I want to say when we talk about the funding here, it begs the other question about the Shia-Sunni thing, because the Shia are targets for the Sunnis. However, as I mentioned earlier, they're working together in South America with the drug cartels and with the human traffickers and with others. We see them working together with Hamas, funding them. On the kind of geostrategic level, the big loser is going to be Saudi Arabia, because they are scared to death as we've pulled out of Iraq, because Iran has their sights on Saudi Arabia. And make no mistake, they're going to make a move, and I think you're going to see Russia in the middle of that one way or the other. So just I throw that out. But when it comes to the funding, they're also getting funding from nation states.
Mm-hmm. To Keith in Elkton, Virginia, hello.
Oh, hello. What a joy to hear someone who just flatly tells it like it is. I'm a pastor. I did a 3.5-year study on Islam and produced a 6-hour teaching series. I use the Holy Bible, and they use the Quran. It would be very fair for you to take the Bible and judge who I am and what I produce or what I say. The Quran, and I quote to you, says that Allah will destroy every Christian and Jew from the face of the earth. I've read it twice. Go ahead and spill their blood upon the ground. It will not be a sin unto you. Allah will forgive you, for you'll be ridding the earth of filth. I think it's fair to take that document and hold it against them. And I want to be quick. The struggle started in Abraham's tent when a bondwoman who was brought from Egypt by Abraham gave birth to Ishmael.
Well, we can't go through the whole biblical lineage. I think you made your point, Keith. I'll ask John to wrap up on that note.
Well, I think what he's saying is true is, you know, Islamic law comes from the Quran. It's important to understand that the concept, the legal concept, which is the Quranic concept of abrogation, means whatever comes chronologically last obliterates, is the word that the Quran uses, anything that came before it that's in dispute. The last chapter or surah in the Quran to talk about jihad is chapter 9. Fight and slay the unbeliever wherever you find them, and lie in wait for them in every stratagem of war. The last chapter to talk about relations between Muslims and
Well, Muslims. All right. I thought we were going to make it, but I would like you to finish that when we come back in just a moment. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show. As we talked with former FBI agent John Guandolo, the man behind the website UnderstandingTheThreat.com, author of Raising a Jihadi Generation. You were replying to the preacher with some things from the Quran, John.
Well, the point I was making is that when you look at the Quran and how it's understood, there were two points I was making. One, the last two chapters, the last chapter to discuss jihad, I quoted Surah 9, and Surah 5, chapter 5, is the last chronologically to discuss relations between Muslims and non-Muslims. And in there it says, O ye who believe, take not the Jews and Christians as your friends there, but Christian friends and protectors of one another. So he is correct. That's the last word. So chronologically, that's it. That's done. That's Allah's final word on those issues. So jihad is a command for all time. Muhammad is the most perfect example of a man according to Islam. And Muhammad said, I've been commanded to fight and slay the unbelievers until they testify there's no God but God. In other words, they convert or they submit to Islam and pay the jizya and become.
Which is essentially what? Protect your money?
Yeah, it's the non-Muslim poll tax. It's a tax on non-Muslims. They have reduced rights under the Islamic State, but they're allowed to live.
How generous.
They have to pay, Allah said it chronologically last in the Quran. Muhammad said it, and then Muhammad went out, and he cut people's heads off, and he burned people's eyes, and he did these things that were commanded in the Quran. So he is an example for all times. The last piece of that is when we talk about this as being law, this is law. Every verse in the Quran has been legally defined by the scholars. And there are volumes of works that are completely unanimously accepted by Islam as being the rigorous definitions of each sentence, each verse in the Quran. So for somebody to say, you know, what this means to me is, well, that's nice that that's what that means to you, but it's a legal system. So it's defined legally. I just find that when people kind of come to realize that, they realize this is very different. So when you make the comparison should not be to Hindus or Jews or Christians. The comparison should be to different forms of government. Communism, democracy, constitutional republic, because that's what you're dealing with him. It's a totalitarian system.
It is that. It's not coincidental that during World War II, the Arab movement found such common cause with the Nazis. It wasn't just that they were both fighting the British, but ideologically, there was much in common. Saddam Hussein, for example, was known as a man who, worship would be right, deeply respected Hitler and Mussolini.
That's right. And you've got these examples throughout history. The one I brought up in my article this week was the Grand Mufti of Palestine who goes to visit Adolf Hitler in a very tremendously promoted event by the Germans. And in fact, this relation, now for those not understanding, the Grand Mufti is the senior legal scholar of that entire area.
As close as there is to an Islamic pope.
That's right, for those areas. But again, it would be more like the prime minister or the Supreme Court justice, but with all the executive powers as well. So here's the senior legal jurist, the Grand Mufti for Palestine with Hitler. And out of that, we see the rise of an all-Bosnian Muslim SS division that fought in World War II. And these are things that a lot of people, some of the history people don't know. So you have the National Socialists in Germany, the Nazi Party, just arm in arm with the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamic Jihadis in World War II.
We'll wrap on that note. John, thank you very much for being with us tonight. John Guandolo, the author of Raising a Jihadi Generation and the man behind the website UnderstandingTheThreat.com. We'll take a quick break on The Bohannon Show, and when we come back, we'll talk with noted actor Stacy Keach in just a moment. Have you ever catch the program American Greed? It's on CNBC. You can see it at 10 p.m. Pacific and Eastern times on Thursday evenings. And our host is joining us right now, the host of American Greed, Stacy Keach, the award-winning actor, known, of course, to many people as Mike Hammer. Stacy, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Jim, for inviting me.
Absolutely. For those who haven't seen the show, what is American Greed all about?
Well, it's about, as they say, some people will do anything for money. It's about people who will do those things, and much to the chagrin of the public. But they are cautionary tales. They're saying if something sounds too good to be true, it probably is. It's about fraud. It's about a lot of Ponzi schemes. And as an actor, I enjoy the experience because for me it's sort of like research. I get to witness the behavior of some of these pathological sociopaths and also the behavior of the victims, the police, the people who catch, you know, and the judges. So there's a wide variety of social of people that I get a chance to draw, you know, to sort of suck the behavior out of them in terms of what roles I might be playing in the future.
Mm-hmm. Are these people, do they tend to be, if they're successful, fairly good actors themselves, albeit in a very negative context?
The show that we are doing, celebrating our 100th episode, is about Barry Minko. And I don't know if you remember him. He had a carpet cleaning company called Z-Best Carpet Cleaning and turned out to be a Ponzi scheme. He went to jail for 5 years, came out, went and joined the church, became a pastor, stole money from them, then created his own fraud network. He said, nobody knows fraud better than I do. Catch these fraudsters, send me, and after big corporations. This man, talk about acting. Had he been an actor, he would have been a great actor. But unfortunately, he took the wrong door down the hall.
Mm-hmm. But had he taken the right door, could he actually have been, do you think, a professional actor?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
I don't know. But he had such charisma. If he told you something, you believed him. And, of course, credibility is what acting is all about.
Absolutely.
And so he certainly had it.
Now, this particular...
That's our 100th episode.
The one that's coming up, as a matter of fact, on Thursday night, is your 100th episode. In all of those episodes, are there any that jump out in your mind as being, I don't know, particularly bizarre or pathetic or any that stand out in your mind?
There are a number of pathetic ones. I mean, I've always taken the movie, and as I mentioned, actors who went sad, a little bit different. Creating false situations of they need medical attention, dermatologists. The medical people are the ones that I despise the most, and that abuse children too. But one of the most interesting stories is about two women, foreigners, who took out insurance policies on homeless people, had them sign over everything to them, gave them they would give them money, and then they would go out and murder them, run them over with cars. And they were caught on tape revealing all of this information when they were being interviewed by the police. And it's all documented on tape. It was a fascinating story. Sad, tragic, awful, but still engaging and very gripping.
Well, indeed. I would imagine that if you do enough of these shows, that it might make you a bit of a cynic.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, it doesn't speak well for our society. But, I think everybody has somewhere inside them they understand and can identify with greed, wanting more, even if it's more something good, something that's, not just money or power, or fame or wanting more of anything, more love or comfort. We all know what those feelings are, and I think that by watching people these students have gotten out of control when they've gone beyond what the parameters of legality and, and destroy people's lives.
Indeed. Most of us, it would seem to me, most people are not very well prepared for dealing with the unscrupulous like this. There is probably, most of us, a certain inherent element of trust, which, that element of trust, honestly, I suppose, makes society capable of moving forward. I mean, for example, if I have a flat